to talk about order. This will be two-dimensional order. So we have some set of particles that will be interacting typically with a repulsive interaction, because that's what leads typically to order, but on a curved two-dimensional surface. So we know a lot about how things order in flat space, both two and three dimensions. If you have particles interacting in the plane, they almost always form a regular triangular lattice. And if you extend it, as we've seen several times in this meeting, to extend that to, for example, disks packing a plane, then each disk will kiss six nearest neighbors. And we have a very regular kind of configuration. And we know a lot about Bravais lattices, lattice arrangements in the plane, and in three-dimensional space. But as soon as you curve the two-dimensional surface a little bit, go away from the plane, then we know much less. And I'll be talking today about basically classical ground states, so the temperature will be zero, but my controlling parameter will be the spatial curvature of the system, say the Gaussian curvature. And I want to try to convince you that quite a bit of interesting physics can happen that's curvature-driven. Qualitatively new phenomena can occur when you curve the system up, give it some non-trivial geometry. And, of course, there's a very large number of two-dimensional manifolds you can consider, and there are a lot of parameters you can vary. You can vary some microscopic potential of the particles and the number of particles. I will concentrate mostly on the prototypical example of the sphere, constant positive Gaussian curvature, and then try to indicate what happens with the other manifolds. There are also many kinds of questions you can ask. For example, if we have particles interacting with a pairwise repulsive power law potential on this two-dimensional surface, we can ask for energy-minimizing optical kind of configurations, and we can ask how universal they are with respect to varying the potential. Now, this is an idea that Henry Kohn has emphasized, universal optimality. And to give you an idea that this is not trivial, if you take just five particles interacting on the surface of a sphere, for power laws up to something like 30, the ground state is a triangular bipyramid, so it's an equilateral triangle, three particles, one equally above and one equally below. And then when the power law gets bigger than 30, that becomes unstable, and you get a configuration with a pyramidal base, four vertices, below the equator, and one particle at the northern hemisphere. So this is a non-universal optimality of that problem. If you have four particles, they're always at the vertices of a tetrahedron. If you have eight, they live at the vertices of a twisted cube. And if they're 12, they're at the vertices of an icosahedron. But generally, there's going to be some variation with the power law. Typically in physical systems, and there are physical systems that can model these things I'm going to be talking about, we don't know precisely what the power law potential is. So I'm interested in looking at some coarser descriptions of the ground states that may be more universal. For example, what is the topological configuration of the ground state? What are the topological defects, and how are they arrayed? So this is the structure of the Fakete points that was mentioned in Nick Makarov's seminar. So just to give you an idea, here's a planar system, polystyrene beads that are assembled on water at an air interface. So they sit, the surface tension is such that they like to sit at this interface, and they make a beautiful triangular lattice. This was done by Pavel Kerensky in the early 80s. This can now be done on the surface of a water droplet. So you can make a spherical kind of crystal. And I'm going to be talking about work that was done primarily with Alex Traversett, who's at Iowa State, and David Nelson at Harvard. And we made some predictions about the structure of spherical crystals in our first paper in 2000. And since then, we've interacted a lot with experimentalists and worked with experimentalists to check these predictions in physical systems. here I'm just giving schematically, generalizing that planar system to a curve system. Here is shown a cartoon of a buckyball, a fullerene molecule. You can also make spherical systems of multi-electron bubbles in helium. If you pile up electrons on the surface of liquid helium, there's an instability when the density gets big enough and a bubble forms, and you have a bubble of helium vapor inside the bulk liquid helium that's coated with about a million to 100 million electrons. You can have protein molecules, as in the capsids called capsomeres, that make capsids that protect viral DNA or RNA. But the most accessible systems are colloidal systems. We have something like this, micron scale polystyrene colloidal beads that assemble on droplets in emulsions. And the kind of thing, because we're working on curved surfaces, in general, the topology will mean that we cannot have a perfect triangular lattice, as in planar space on the surface, but the topological defects and disclinations that Gerhard discussed, non-six-fold coordinated points, and I'll be interested in the structure of these objects, whether they occur as isolated disclinations, as have been assumed for a very long time, in particular in studying this problem in the mathematics literature. This problem in the mathematics literature is known as the Thompson problem for the two-sphere. And I will try to convince you that these defects appear when the system gets big enough in delocalized structures that are like grain boundaries, the grain boundaries that freely terminate inside the system. Here's an example shown up here. Here's trying a grain boundary in a bulk material. The grain boundaries, because there's a mismatch of crystallographic axes, always go to the boundary of the system. And this is an image from a real spherical crystal, and this is a numerical simulation. Even though they came after the theoretical work, I just describe a little bit more this experimental system. So as I said, this is a liquid-liquid emulsion, known as a Pickering emulsion. So you have water droplets floating in oil, or oil droplets floating in water. Which pictures I'll show you are all water droplets floating in oil. And if you choose the right kind of colloidal bead, the surface tension is such that a bead is, the difference between the surface tension of the bead and liquid A and the surface tension of the bead and liquid B is much less than the liquid A, liquid B interfacial surface tension, then that bead will always, always preferentially sit at the interface to exclude some interface volume. Therefore, surface tension drives it to sit at the surface, and if they have sufficient thermal mobility when they reach the surface, they can coat the whole droplet. So you have a spherical droplet kept spherical by the surface tension of the droplet itself, and you can have varying sizes, and you can coat that object completely and look for ordered states of these beads on the system. And because they're mesoscopic in scale, you can optically image them.
How do you prevent it from dissolving the water in the oil?
That's a good question. Generally, water and oil are immiscible, but water does dissolve a little bit in these oils slowly over the time scale of the experiment. But actually that helps, because if you have a certain number of particles on the system, the droplet will shrink and increase the density, and that can actually help to drive crystallization.
No, I'm talking about, you're saying that the beads act as a surfactant.
Yes,
they act as a surfactant.
So couldn't that eventually make the whole system, the water dissolve in the oil? I mean, you have mesoscopic scale droplets.
Yes.
Okay. Now you're lowering the surface tension.
Right.
Couldn't that possibly make the droplets dissolve?
They do, but slowly. So the diameter can change a few percent over a time scale of the experiment, an hour. Okay. They're perfectly, if you have two perfectly, immiscible liquids, it wouldn't dissolve at all. And the system will be stabilized by the colloidal surfactant. But in fact, you're right. There always is some dissolving going on. So it has to happen not too rapidly. And fortuitously, actually, a little bit of this happening helps to drive crystallization, I think. By the way, and this kind of system appears in supermarket shelves, particularly in British mayonnaise. You have oil and vinegar, and in that case, the colloidal particle is mustard seed. So Pickering emulsions are commercially good or bad, depending on your point of view. British mayonnaise. Here's a picture. This is from the group of Andreas Bausch, the Technical University of Munich, of one of these droplets. So this is what you're asking about. This is a water droplet. There's a 1 micron diameter polystyrene bead. And you can see, actually you can see a kind of pentagonal shape here because there's a five-fold coordinated particle in the middle. And you can see that they jiggle around and they're able to equilibrate. And you can make from a few hundred to a few thousand, depending on the diameter of the droplet particles on this thing. So we want to know what is this crystal structure here? You can see crystallographic axes, they curve.
So what's the thing? There's like an inner ball and an outer ball.
So this is regular optical microscopy. It's not confocal microscopy. So you're only imaging a spherical cap. So it goes out of focus, it goes beyond the depth of focus at some point. Here you see about 10% of the surface. Later I'll show you a picture that has 2 pi of the 4 pi steradians of the sphere. So we see half the surface. For that you need fluorescently labeled beads, and you can use them CAT scanning, confocal microscopy, take a whole slice of images and get the whole 3D structure. Fortunately, you only need about 1/12 of the sphere because the thickness cell is typically a 1/12, so you can get the whole structure on part of it. So I'll show this picture later, but this is what happens when we're on a sphere. There's going to be some five-fold coordinated points because of the topology of the sphere. And we assume that we have a triangulation on the sphere, and we sum up the departure of all the vertices on the sphere, the departure of their coordination number from 6, then we have to get 6 times the Euler character of the sphere, that's a topological invariant, which is 2, we have to get 12. The simplest solution would be 12 five-fold coordinated points of the vertices of an icosahedron. When these spherical crystals are small, that's what you get. And shown on the left is just a few hundred particles, and you triangulate about a 10th or 12th of the surface, and you get one isolated 5, shown here. But here's 3,000 particles, and this is about 2/12 of the surface, and you see that this particle becomes delocalized as these extended structures that we call scars. Gerhard mentioned them, and I want to tell you how this structure comes about. So it occurs as for increasing particle number.
What's the difference between the red and the yellow dots?
Yellow are 7-fold coordinated, and the red are 5-fold coordinated. So these objects here are a string of 5s and 7s, and if you count it, there's one excess 5. So this is this morphs into this extended structure. The 5 is surrounded by a set of tightly bound 5s and 7s, which are actually dislocation.
But it seems like you have 3 strings there that all have excess 5s on them.
No, there's one here. This is really part of the same one. This is finite temperature now. And these are isolated dislocations, indicating that the system hasn't yet equilibrated. This is probably will disappear.
But the left one still has an excess 5, I think.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 5s. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
So it's the top left guy starts and ends with the red, the bottom left guy starts and ends with the red, the top right guy starts and ends with the red. It seems like too many excess 5s.
No, this is part of one. So here's one excess 5.
Yep.
This whole chain here is one excess 5.
Right.
And that's the second one. And this
third
up there is non-equilibrium.
Right.
This here. And so forget this and this.
Is this just part of the sphere?
Yeah, this is 2/12, roughly 20% of the sphere. This is experimental data.
So it's 2/12, so we expect to see 2 excess 5s, and we actually see 3, and that's not so bad.
No, this is not. not part, this is not part. You can, we can predict the predicted length of a scar for this system size, and it's one of these. So this is one scar, this is another, this is a non-equilibrium. This one dislocation that's not part of, not an equilibrium. And same, so this could be part of a scar going down this side. This is not an equilibrium structure. This is what you should compare with. This becomes that. And if I show 2/12 of the surface, there'll be another isolated 5 that just become that. So this is the question. What is the ground state of m particles constrained to move on the surface of the sphere? So we've gone from this triangular to this, and now we know what happens here. So it's some notation, 6-fold coordinated point, so the irregular point. 5-fold coordinated point, that is a disclination in two-dimensional condensed matter physics. I call it +1 charged object. The charge is 6 minus its coordination number. 7-fold coordinated point will be a charge -1 disclination. Two of these tightly bound together make a 5 and 7 make a dislocation. You can have a higher defect charges as well, but typically the energies grow at the square of the defect charges, so they don't appear very often. Said the Euler characteristic, V minus E plus F plus 2, translates for a triangulation because E and F are related. E is 3 times the number of faces divided by 2. You can rewrite that as the sum over the nodes of 6 minus the coordination number. Call this a topological charge Q. So the total topological charge has to be 12. That can be satisfied in an infinite number of ways. And we want to know how it's actually realized for ground state configurations. Possibly interacting particles, of course, as the total number of particles varies, particularly as it gets large. Here's another more general manifold, I'll talk a little bit later, the torus. It's more interesting because the curvature, gas and curvature is spatially varying, but also quite a bit harder. Okay, so as I said, we consider power law potentials given by a power gamma. That we're just going to sum up those power law potentials, 1 over the Euclidean distance in R3 to that power, and look at the system. Let's start with, the plane. Solution on the plane is a perfect triangular lattice, unless you fine-tune the potential to favor something like the square root of 2 next to the nearest neighbors, which can give you a square lattice. You can write the coordination number in terms of basis vectors, E1 and E2. This is very standard. Then you do standard UOL summation techniques. There's a natural two regimes, long range and short range interactions. In D dimensions, the crossover always occurs when the power law equals the dimensionality. So in 2 dimensions, it occurs for gamma equals 2, 1 over R squared. So if gamma is less than 2, have some infrared divergence. So you can construct this energy minus, subtract and add this term here. This is convergent for gamma less than 2. This is divergent but cut off by the system size for us. This is like some power of m. We take density m over a, it's 1 over the area per unit cell. And then we can consider departures from a perfect triangular lattice modeled through elasticity, two-dimensional elasticity theory, lambda emissions. We have Lemay coefficients, mu and lambda. U alpha beta is the strain tensor. So U are like phonons. It's given down here. And in particular, in general, the system can also, when we consider departures from planar systems, it can have also a height. And we'll use this to get energy for a curved surface in a little bit. So now let's take the case of the sphere. We have a 0-point energy corresponding to ordering on the plane. So this will give us a term here, this term that I subtracted and added that grows like the number of particles m squared. That's the term n minus 1 that Nick wrote in his seminar. For large m, written here as m, that goes like m squared. Density is m over 4 pi r squared. So the energy of the impossible topologically planar configuration of the sphere is an expansion in the number of particles. Leading term n squared, essentially the number of pairs, and then the term, the next term goes like 1 plus gamma over 2. So it'd be m to the 3 halves for the Coulomb potential, e squared over r gamma, and then correction terms. And this coefficient theta, you can compute for any particular gamma. If gamma is greater than 2, the short range interactions, this term will be absent. You can compute also the Lemé coefficients to put in the elasticity theory when you deform the surface and introduce some Gaussian curvature. So these coefficients are computed here. So in the end, we're going to write a Hamiltonian that just has a couple of parameters in it, and we're going to actually map the problem onto a problem of interacting the topological defects, and which has far fewer degrees of freedom, and determine the ground state of that problem. These are the elasticity coefficients computed on the plane. And then you put that all together, you get this kind of structure here. So it has this m squared term, this term that goes like m to the 1 plus gamma over 2, and then it has a contribution that's coming from elasticity. It's going to be non-trivial around a on a curved surface. And we're going to discuss the first case of constant positive curvature, namely the sphere. Mu and lambda are known. And this term here will depend on the configuration of particles on the surface, and in particular on the distribution of topological defects on the surface.
And what is the eta function?
Oh, I mean, that's just something that you can...
Oh, these are constants?
Yes. Here, it only depends on the power law. You just have to do those usual sums,
but
for different powers of gamma. So this is constants which we calculated and tabulate, so you can compare with different potentials. Actually, the reason I want to do this is I want to control for the defect Hamiltonian. Make sure that when the defects are isolated, I reproduce results from, I can compare with numerical simulations and check how well this theory works in the normal case, small number of particles. So let me show you how we map this onto a defect Hamiltonian. We go from the particle Hamiltonian to the defect Hamiltonian. This is well known in the theory of membranes. So in that case, you have a fluctuating two-dimensional elastic surface. I'm going to consider the case where the bending rigidity is very large. So I'm below this buckling transition that Gerhard talked about. I'm going to retain a fixed but non-trivial two-dimensional geometry, having large bending rigidity. But if you take this Hamiltonian and integrate out the phonons that appear here, then you get a Hamiltonian that has the following form. It has an interaction between the Gaussian curvature k at point x and point y on the surface, and it interacts through a Green's function, which is biharmonic. Not the Laplacian, but the Laplacian squared, fourth order operator. Coefficient that appears out in here is a combination of those Lemé coefficients, which is the two-dimensional Young's modulus. And if you have defects in this problem, they act as sources of this Gaussian curvature. In other words, if you have a five-fold coordinated point, it naturally likes to live in a conical kind of geometry, as Gerhard discussed, and a seven likes to live in hyperbolic, saddle-like geometry. And really what's important here is the Gaussian curvature minus the defect charge density. So this is just, you have a set of defects, charge Q, that's 6 minus the coordination number, located at points xi, and we get this kind of Hamiltonian. And for n defects, we'll have a core energy also associated with the defect. So,
Six minus CI.
So six-fold coordinated particles. Everything that's not a defect now is being treated as a continuum elastic background. So we want to know the defect structure of this optimum, of the spherical crystal.
Excuse me, what's the argument of the delta function?
Of the delta function? It's a point, x and xi. It's zero unless xi is sitting at it. It's just, well, delta of x minus xi. It's written as x comma. Well, this means that the point defects. So the beautiful thing about this is now we've mapped this problem so that these coefficients y and ec, actually ec is quite small typically, so we can almost ignore it. Y depends on the microscopic potential. Nothing else depends on the microscopic potential. This Green's function here is universal. So we describe all interactions at once. So if when we get some features of the ground state of the system, we'll apply to all interactions. And some things will not even depend on these parameters y and ec. So those are those microscopic parameters. So what do we need? We need this two-dimensional Young's modulus that we can compute. It's just this e to function. It grows like this. We need the energy on the plane. So we have a sort of a reference energy. And then we need to compute the biharmonic operator on the manifold of interest. On the sphere, you can compute this. Geodesic analog, some curved space analog of basically logarithmic interaction, defects interactively logarithmically, disclinations on a two-dimensional surface, and it's shown explicitly here. Beta is the geodesic distance between two points, x and y, the outer squared of x and y. It grows like r squared. This will be x squared log x in two dimensions, and x squared appears on the scale r squared. Then we have, that gives us everything in terms of two parameters, the Young's modulus and the core energy of a defect. So we pass to that problem and we minimize that problem. Here's our total energy. The leading term is always like m squared, unless gamma is 2 or higher. Notice gamma equals 2, these two agree. And this term picks up contribution, has a contribution from the plane, and then it has this extra contribution that depends on where you put the defects in the system. Notice that the topological constraint is satisfied by an arbitrary number of 5s and 7s as long as their difference is 12. So now I want to know where the defects sit. So this Hamiltonian for the defects can be written in this simple form here, Young's modulus y, qi, qb, beta. So we have pairwise interaction between defects, but with a Hamiltonian, that's this chi function is this biharmonic function on the manifold. So we just have to study this Hamiltonian now. To check that things work, let's consider the case where the defects are what was assumed for a long time. We only have the minimal number of defects allowable by the topology. That's 12 5s and an arbitrary number of 6-fold coordinated points that make the sort of elastic manifold that the system swims in. They're an infinite two-parameter family of regular triangulations of the sphere that have 12 5s, and they're characterized by the path that you would take to go from one 5 to a neighboring 5. So they're if you go from 1-5 by n steps on the lattice this way, a 60 degree turn, and then m steps this way, this is called an n-m lattice. And this is possible for the total number of particles m is 10 n squared plus m squared plus n-m plus 2. So this corresponds to a triangulation on the plane where you take a vector n times e1 plus m times e2, and then you use that to tessellate the sphere. And it has in it 12 5s separated in that way, arranged in that way. So here's shown, for example, a 6-6 lattice. So on this one, this is an energy map of the corresponding number of particles on the sphere. To go from this one to this one, you go 6 steps this way, turn 6 and go to here. That's how you get from this 5 to this. So what we did, we computed the C coefficient just for isolated 5s on the sphere and a bunch of geometries like this. one where m equals 0, so n 0 kind of configurations, another where n equals m. Interestingly, these structures are chiral as well. For n not equal to m, they occur in chiral and antimorphs. This A1 coefficient on the previous slide is given by the contribution here, that C coefficient is 0.604. So this is basically the R squared growth of defects living on the surface of a sphere when they're isolated of this form. This is a universal coefficient, doesn't depend on gamma. Now, R squared growth, because if you have a disclination on the sphere, it's made, in flat space it will be made by taking a 60 degree wedge of material and removing it, and then sewing the edges together. To do that, you create a strain that grows basically as the radius, R. Its derivative is constant, and you have to integrate it over a surface that gives you something that grows quadratically with the system size. So an energy of an isolated disclination in two-dimensional space grows as the system size squared. On the sphere, the system size is cut off by the radius of the sphere. So it grows as the radius squared, R squared. For R small, that's not too bad. But when R gets very large, isolated disclination defects have a very large elastic strain energy. Remember, I'm not allowing the system to buckle. So it cannot relieve elastic strain by buckling and faceting, as Gerhard discussed. The bending rigidity is effectively very, very large. So it can only relieve elastic strain by elastic deformations of the intrinsic surface. But there is a way for a system to do that. It can bring up 5-7 pairs, namely dislocations, that sort of screen the elastic strain. It's well known in flat space that if you force in a disclination in the center of a sample, you'll create a grain boundary. That's a line of dislocations. But it has to go all the way, as I said at the beginning of the lecture, to the boundary of the space. On the sphere, you can lower this coefficient here by introducing dislocations, but the crystallographic axes are curved. Therefore, a system is able, over some finite angular distance, planes that started out parallel can converge, and you can heal the crystallographic mismatch associated with the grain boundary. Across the grain boundary, crystallographic axes bend by some angle. But if you move away from the across the surface of the sphere, they can close in, and the crystallographic mismatch can go all the way to zero. So it's actually possible to have a finite angular length grain boundary. That's what we call the grain boundary scar. And it turns out that those structures lower this R squared growth of the total energy of the system. So above a critical number of particles, they will be favored configurations. These dislocation defects that appear in the ground state of the system will be thermal excitation in any two-dimensional planar system. But here, they are properties, intrinsic properties of the ground state. So here's just shown without having isolated defects. We just did numerical simulations for a whole bunch of gammas and structures like that, and showed that the defect Hamiltonian reproduces to 5 decimal places the energy of the system. And then we can go on and see what happens if the defects these defects delocalize into these scar-like structures. So this is what we found. So the analytical theory then can be pushed, because you have far fewer degrees of freedom. You can model 20,000 particles with a few hundred defects. The analytical theory can be pushed to a much larger number of particles than direct numerical simulations, and it's found that for sufficiently large number of particles, you get these radial grain boundaries of dislocations. You just put in disclinations, but the disclinations pair up into dislocations which screen the isolated fibres. So this is the kind of structure that you get. So this is what you would hope to get in the ideal experiment if it were really t equals 0. Okay? So you see here there are 12 of these grain boundaries, but each structure here is a linear structure. The scar has basically can be thought of as a central fire with two arms like that, going out in each direction, 1x5 in each of these structures. These structures are interesting also, from one of the reasons I'm interested in these is that these droplets are candidates for mesoscale atoms that can be put, that can be used to make mesoscale materials, or mesoscale molecules first of all, and then bulk materials. And the defects play a crucial role because defects can be functionalized. You put in dirt into the system, colloid of a slightly different size, or in some cases you can coat defects with, say, gold or something like that. You can make these defect patches sticky, and then you can attach bonds here or ligands. And so the preferred number of defects, which is 12 in this case, is determined by the topology, determines the valency of this mesoscale molecule. And the structure of the defects will determine how easy it is to functionalize them. For example, the fact that you have sevens here, and you don't, when they're isolated fives, maybe you can take advantage of that to do chemistry with sevenfold coordinated things that help to functionalize these defects. Yeah. Here's shown the dual Voronoi cell for another kind of ground state of several thousand particles interacting, this case, time with the one over RQ potential on the sphere. So here you see these lines of pentagons and heptagons, dual to the fives and sevens, with 1x5. Notice you can see some other kinds of structures also corresponding to a multi-arm. This corresponds to a five-arm structure rather than a two. Sometimes at the same, this is for one end. The dislocations actually have a variable spacing within a scar. So if this is the central five, look at this dislocation here, it comes up very close. And the next one is further away, and the next one is further away, until the last one doesn't even bind. It's effectively infinitely far away. That's why it doesn't bind. The reason is that a dislocation is attracted to the central five, but the charge here is screened by the Gaussian curvature, by the crystallographic axis closing. So this one here sees an effectively reduced charge, and it's further away, and doesn't bind as tightly. This way you can actually predict the length of a scar. So we did that calculation. But let me show you again the picture I showed at the beginning. So this is these two droplets from the experiment of Bausch's, first done at the Waits group at Harvard and then Technical University of Munich. On the left is just a few hundred particles, an isolated five, and on the right is this picture that you saw before. Here's the calculation of the length of a scar. So a triangular lattice, this length is each side of the central five, turns out to be arc cosine of 5/6. 6 is the coordination number of a triangular lattice, 5 is 1 minus it. And it's, that goes out that distance on each side, so they're roughly 67 degrees in extent, and then terminate. They don't cross. You could calculate this number on a square lattice as well if you could make one, and it's longer because you have a basically, you have a 90 degree dislocation, so it's harder to screen it. So the scar will be longer. And you can compute the total. There's a linear structure, the number of excess dislocations per scar is computed here, and it grows as 0.41 times r over the mean particle space of A. This number here doesn't depend on the Young's modulus or the core energy of a defect, so it's completely universal. It should occur for any kind of structure. And that we've compared with experiment, and it fits pretty well. So red is a theoretical prediction. This is a number of these structures that are called colloidosomes, these spherical crystals. And look at the scars on about 42 different samples, and look at this one.
Which is what's better, offset?
Offset. This shows that if the system, if R is too small, so R over A is less than 5, so this corresponds to less than something like 350 particles, the defects are purely isolated 5s, no excess dislocations. So that's why I said there's a critical system size above which the R squared growth of isolated dislocations is big enough that pays to add, pay the core energy of defects and screen. So that's the threshold. And that number is not universal, that'll depend on gamma, but not very strongly. All right, so here's some 3D image. So with the Bausch group. We published a paper in Langmuir where the colloidal particles are now have fluorescently labeled. You can use laser scanning for focal microscopy and see half of the northern hemisphere and half of the southern hemisphere of the sphere. Here, the beads, which are PMMA silica beads, don't crystallize quite as well, so the scars are jagged. But you can see there are three scars on top, three on the bottom, or six on half the sphere, corresponding to 12 on the total sphere. And then you see some isolated non-equilibrium dislocations. So it's experimental data. It's not as beautiful as numerical simulations, but it's quite impressive. Really. There's no guarantees that this would come out as fine. You can also estimate the length, and 67 degrees fits quite well. That is a micron-sized water droplet coated with several thousand silica beads. Other geometries. We have my students, Luca Jombi, Homan Shin, Brayton Thomas, have made a spinning analog of an old experiment due to Bragg and Nye, which they made soap bubble graphs in two dimensions as beautiful models of 2D crystals. You can read about it in Feynman's Lectures in Physics, Volume 2. We took that system and spun it up, so he makes a paraboloidal shape, and you can make nice soap bubbles on this paraboloidal surface. And you can, Luca Jombi and I, this is solved the biharmonic operator on the paraboloid. Now you have a boundary, and looked at the structures that you get there, and we can also compare with the experiment. And you see scars that go down from the outside down to the center of the sample.
It would appear there's a large excess charge on the boundary. Is that?
Yes. So, this is an artifact of the Delaunay triangulation, because on the boundary, 4 would be a neutral object,
yeah.
3 would be a charge, so you should ignore this labeling on the boundary. But the boundary plays a very important role. So that's a new feature. On the paraboloid, you have both variable Gaussian curvature, where the curvature is higher on the bottom and lower as you go out, and you have also a boundary. Yes?
I was just wondering, have you looked at the dynamical effects?
We're in the process of doing that, but I can't see anything. How it makes a crystal, yeah. That's very interesting. We have to do this by actually forming it first in the plane and spinning it up, because otherwise, if you form it, so one interesting thing will be to spin it down and see what happens to the defects.
But also good to vary the depth would be your problem over time and then see whether you
that would correspond to varying the
height.
All of those are very interesting questions, and I'll show you one dynamical thing shortly. But the one interesting thing happens is you can have defects on the, so the, now the Euler character is 1, right, for the disk paraboloid. So the total defect charge is 6. So you can have all the defects on the boundary, or you can have, for example, a defect in the interior and one on the boundary. And as you vary the parameters, the geometry of the paraboloid, it's basically given by the height divided by the radius squared, you can have a structural phase transition from 6 defects on the boundary of charge plus 1 to 5 on the boundary and 1 in the center. And if you allowed the boundary to deform in shape, this will be a transition from sort of a hexagonal base to a pentagonal base. You have a structurally driven shape transition in this system in principle. You can get coexistence, you can have isolated 5s here, isolated disclinations, scars, and then coexistence on the bottom, an isolated 5, and as you go up on the paraboloid, scars because of the variable Gaussian curvature. So that's also a new feature. It's just some Voronoi pictures for the paraboloid. We have also solved this problem on the torus, and we have simulations. You can find it on this website here, written by myself, Chris Chaker, and Ellen Middleton, who featured in the last talk. Just Google Thompson problem, and this will be the first one that you find. You can see this applet simulates particles interacting on the sphere or the torus and does a simultaneous delineate triangulation. So you can see the topological structure of the mesh. And so you can image that, you can sign on as a database, you can save configurations and so on. So let me just show you one thing that happens on the torus. So on the torus, the Euler character is zero. There's no topological necessity for defects. Nevertheless, energetics can drive the appearance of defects, just like the excess defects appeared on the sphere. So this is some kind of structures that we see on the torus. You can have scars going this way, or scars going this way, and they can have different length because the curvature is different. And sometimes they spiral across the sphere. So we're in the process of trying to systematically analyze this. Remember total number of fives and sevens. These are.
Do they go on? Yeah.
So I can see some which start and end in red, some which start in yellow, and
yes, that's right. So what happens for a small number of particles, actually, even for this system, where no defects are required topologically, you get isolated fives on the outside where the Gaussian curvature is positive, and isolated sevens on the inside. So the scars in on the outside will typically have one excess five, and things on the inside one excess seven. So that's why this one has charge, net charge plus one. This one is neutral because it's going across this way. It doesn't correspond to a delocalized five sitting on the outside. It's a neutral object going this way.
It's neutral, but it's polarized.
It's connecting a 5 and 7 on the outside and the inside. It's a scar that's connecting 5 to a 7. Yeah. Yes?
I think in all your simulations, we never saw an 8 with a 4.
So go to that website and you'll see some 8s. It's because the energy grows as the thing that multiplies the core energy, basically, grows as the square of the basic charge. Because it's like it's not additive. It's additive and then squared. So an 8 costs 4 times as much energy as a 7. So typically unstable to 2-7. But for small numbers of particles, you will see some 4s or some 8s. So did I answer your question well? Okay. If you consider so-called hexatic ground state on the torus. So this is a state in which you have, in the plane, some finite density of dislocations which disturb the translational order of the system. And then you consider a dislocation that's centered on the zero curvature line of the torus. The five is being, they have an attractive logarithmic interaction that binds them together. But there's also an external field, the Gaussian curvature, that drives a five to the outside and a seven to the inside. We have shown in this paper with Alex Travis and David Nelson that for a large range of aspect ratios and particle numbers and so on, the unbinding wins. So that the dislocation unbinds, you get isolated disclinations in the hexatic state that doesn't appear in a planar system, with the 5 out here and the 7 in here. So this is curvature-driven dislocation unbinding. It's a curvature-driven analog of melting. And in particular, this always occurs when the aspect ratio goes to 1, where the system becomes fat. The torus becomes fat because the Gaussian curvature on the inside goes to minus infinity. And so there's a very strong, 7 is very strongly attracted to the inside, always unbinds. Finally, besides delocalization, besides delocalization, there's another very interesting effect that occurs in these systems, which has to do with kinetics and also structures of defects. In this case, another defect, an interstitial or a vacancy. So let us start with one of these regular triangulations of the sphere corresponding to m equals 8 and m equals 3. If you work that out, this is 972 particles. So you can do that with this. I'm going to show a movie that's taken from that applet, Thompson applet, on that website I gave you. And I'm going to start with this regular triangulation. And I'm going to add one particle in the center. And we will try to see what happens. So I'm going to start it and then stop it. Stop it here. Okay, so this was an 8-3. Actually, I think. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3. This was the initial state. And then with this applet, what you can do is add or remove particles. So I added a particle right at the center of this geodesic triangle. It's an interstitial. Notice an interstitial morphs and becomes this complex of dislocations in a hexagonal structure. As long as the Burgers factor associated with the zero, this is possible. Interstitial has zero Burgers vector. Any complex of dislocations has zero Burgers vector is allowed. So now we have a very regular system. We've perturbed it just by adding one particle. What do you think will happen here?
Sorry, and what drives the dynamics?
Oh, so this is just relaxation, just basically steepest descent. We're just running down. So what do you think will happen to this structure? Okay, so this is just the energy. Here it's unbound. Unbound, and these dislocations can glide. Glide means motion along the Burgers vector, which is orthogonal to this link here. Along here, and because I started in the center for this particular configuration, they can glide in and become tightly bound to this 7. So what they do in this case is they form 3 mini scars, I call them. And this just shows the energy is low at forming these scars. So even if the original configuration, and then you can remove a particle and check that the energy is lower than the original number of particles. So this shows that, so this is the beginning, this shows the high energy associated with the disclination. Start it again so you can see it again. This shows that definitely for this number of particles, the energy is lower than these scars are formed. And it also shows that an interstitial is a highly they're unstable. First of all, they're typically stable in flat space. They're highly complicated objects. Anything can happen here. If a dislocation comes in half the lattice space from a 5, it can be annihilated, absorbed by the 5, which will move over one lattice space to preserve the Burgers vector. So you can have particle creation, annihilation, particles can be spit out in pairs, all kinds of processes that are allowed that conserve the total Burgers vector, all driven by the Gaussian curvature system. Let me skip over the self-assembly. You can change the valency of the system by putting pneumatic rods or vector-like particles on the surface, in which case the preferred number of defects is 2p, where the system has p-fold invariances, so you can make 4 valent objects, for example, with spherical pneumatics, which have been produced in the lab now, thin pneumatics shells that have 4 1/2 defects. So the conclusions are that topology determines the broad structure of the ground state of the system. It gives definite valence to these droplet mesoatoms, but energetics determines the detailed structure, namely the shape of the defective regions. This violates icosahedral symmetry for point particles on the sphere. So for along this problem studied in mathematics literature for 100 years. And these extended defect structures, which are kind of natural from the physics point of view, that break icosahedral symmetry were never actually considered. They're all curvature-driven defects. Disclinations have become delocalized rather than point-like. They're linear objects. In the hexagon, you get dislocation unbinding. And interstitials, that one interstitial ended up with 1/3 at each 5. So it's like interstitial fractionization. If you were to think of electrons in the quantum Hall effect, you might be tempted to